A lot of behavior. Jeez.
We just learned how you get bills passed.
How a bill becomes a law.
Grip torture. Vice Chair is instructing us. Welcome to the Senate Revenue Committee. Our order of business this afternoon will be, I'd like to move Senate Bill 415 first, then do House Bill 2671, and then here, House Bill 2043. Open a work session on Senate Bill 415. Mr. Kyle, you want to brief us on the amendments you've had drafted to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Art Kyle, representing the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. You heard the original bill on the 2nd of April, and we put together amendments for that with Elizabeth. My theory on the amendments was that we would apply this factor only to communities of 5,000 citizens or less, and only new naturopaths who have just entered practice would it be applicable to, and the tax credit would be only applicable for 5 years, our people said. If a naturopath can't make it in a rural community in 5 years, they're not going to make it, and they'll probably go away. So we decided to put that in to make the bill a little more palatable. And our estimate is we would probably never have more than one on the far outside, a couple of people that ever would qualify for this provision. So that's our...
What's the fiscal under $5,000?
Yes, the $5,000 tax credit is all the other rural health credit items are.
Great. Thanks. We're in work session on Senate Bill 415.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 415 to the floor of the Duke House.
You need the dash one amendment.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I amend my motion to amend into Senate Bill 14 the dash one amendments.
Senator Farrelly has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 415 discussion.
Do you have your four votes without me?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran?
Well, I appreciate all the good work Mr. Kyle's done. He's just worked diligently on this, and I wish it were a different time so that we could have this discussion in better economic times. But, you know, tax credits at this time are very questionable. So I'll be a no.
Thank you. So Senator Corcoran objects. Terry, do you want to call the roll on the dash one amendment?
No.
Ringo?
Aye.
Carr?
Aye.
Farrelly?
Aye.
Becker?
It's an aye. Carries. Senator Farrelly?
I'm here.
We just adopted that.
Yeah, oh, I beg your pardon. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 415 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Farrelly has moved Senate Bill 415 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I'm happy to do my part to support rural Oregon, and I hope it's reciprocated in other bills.
This will probably be the extent of his support.
Thank you. Further discussion? Kara.
Senator Corcoran?
Nope.
Ringo?
Aye.
Aye.
Ariel?
Aye.
It's an aye. Motion carries.
Yes, Senator. Mr. Farrelly will carry.
Great. Senator Farrelly is our carrier. Open a work session on House Bill 2671. Elizabeth, we've heard this bill before.
Senator Deckert, with House Bill 2671, you basically, the original bill on the A and Gross was just adding a new criteria that allows a business to claim the long-term non-urban enterprise zone property tax incentive. The new conditions are that the total cost of the project to exceed $200 million, the facility has to employ at least 10 full-time employees, the employees are hired at 150% of the county annual average, and the facility is located 10 or more miles from I-5. Now, it applies to exemptions of property of business firms that apply for certification on or after January 1st, 2003, and it takes effect 91 days after the close of the legislative session. Now, you also had the dash A2. That was what we were discussing in the last hearing dealing with the PUC, and the amendment was allowing the separate company reporting not consolidated for those corporate excise tax returns for public utility companies. It was going to affect three public utility companies. So basically that's what the bill was.
Thank you. I'll see Senator Harper, who is the sponsor of the bill. I believe I opened a work session.
You did, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Let me just check on.
Mr. Chairman, I just would speak to the matter for just a moment.
Senator Farrelly.
It's very clear that in the current climate, it's difficult for these organizations that have enjoyed this tax credit to meet the criterion of job creation. And this allows those firms, in fact, to maintain the enterprise zone designation and the incentives, but reorders the requirement for job creation to 10 from 20. Very important to maintain these companies that are currently benefiting from these enterprise zone designations and the tax incentives that we use to get them to locate them. We'd like to see them stay. So this is critically important to doing that, Mr. Chair.
What was convincing to me was, I think, the project that in Klamath Falls, it's a power generating facility. It's an impressive project. I think it's a big investment in Southern Oregon. I think it's a significant investment. And I see this bill as one that wouldn't affect our revenue picture, but it's been negotiated locally, and I think it's a valuable project that hopefully will keep moving along.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Was there any testimony that was persuasive to indicate that if we don't allow this, then we know for certain that the project would not go forward?
So OEDD, would you like to come up? I've been briefed on that, but I think that's a very good question that I've certainly had answered.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm with the Assistant Director of the Economic and Community Development Department. And in answer to Senator Ringo's question, the company and county are convinced that the project cannot move forward without this exemption. The company has made that statement, and the county believes it. So they're willing to support this this approach to the long-term rural enterprise zone. I would first point out that it's not the department's bill. The department doesn't have a strong preference on this either way. It adds a mechanism for qualifying for the exemption, doesn't change any of the existing mechanisms. So it creates a fifth test, a fifth path by which a firm could qualify for this exemption. The department's fine with the statute, the bill.
And my understanding, Mike, is that this is a significant, I want to say $200 million new investment.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, the threshold in the bill is $200 million. The expectation for the project is that it will ultimately run something on the order of $700 to $900 million. It's to be built in two phases, and each phase is roughly the same size, so two $350 or $400 million investments.
Mr. Kemp?
Senator Ringo.
And what is the, if we pass this and if the county goes along with it, which I'm sure that they would, what is the financial impact to the county?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, I've only done quick and dirty arithmetic in my head. My understanding is that the county is willing to forego taxes on the entire $800 million, if that's what it ends up being, in return for a specified amount that will be delivered in the near term. I believe that amount's $500,000.
And so you're telling me that essentially is what we're doing is we're forgiving $500,000 worth of taxes to this, to the project.
Chair Deckert, Senator Ringo, my understanding is that the county will receive $500,000 in payments in lieu of taxes. The taxes that would be paid on the balance of the investment are what would be forgiven.
How much is that?
By the arithmetic in my head, it's on the order of $5 or $6 million.
So if we vote yes on this, potentially we're taking $5 or $6 million away from the county.
Chair Deckert, Senator Ringo, that's the agreement that the county is willing to enter into with the company. Yes.
And the company is a What's the total amount of investment? I mean, this the figure is $200 million, but what's the total amount of the investment?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, the first investment is, as I understand it, and this is all from memory, but I believe that the first phase is $350 to $400 million, and that's mm-hmm. the basis for my assertion of $5 to $6 million in taxes forgiven. The second phase would be approximately the same size, bringing the total investment to, as I understand the number, $700 million to about $900 million, depending on inflation that takes place between now and the construction of that second element.
And so the proponents are claiming that even though they're anticipating $900 million of investment, they're going to walk unless we give them a $5 million break.
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, that's my understanding.
And this is a cogeneration plant that depends on the geothermal potential of the Klamath Basin, correct?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, I'm not clear on that. It's my understanding that this is cited where it is relative to a gas pipeline and that it's a gas-fired generating facility.
I see. But the one of the key factors in citing this then would be the proximity to a natural gas pipeline.
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, that's correct. That's one of three factors that essentially determines where these locate.
Mr. Chair, continue. So in any event, this couldn't go anywhere. There would be a limited number of sites where this could go, and so they can't say, well, we'll go to somewhere in Illinois or someplace unless that also happened to have a natural gas pipeline.
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, that's the case. This facility is a little bit different than the utilities we normally talk about in that it's what is called a merchant generating facility. They're actually building this thing not to serve a specific market area, but to sell on the open market. Mm-hmm. The market they're targeting is the West Coast market. So it couldn't be built just anywhere,
right.
But specifically to serve the West Coast market, it needs to be built where there's an adequate source of fuel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
It's impossible for us to know for sure what the impact of this would be. Potentially, this could make a difference, but I suspect it wouldn't. I suspect that they have decided to site in Klamath Falls for a wide range of reasons. Probably the most important one is the natural gas pipeline. But land requirements, the population, the infrastructure of Klamath Falls, all those things have probably convinced them that they want to go to Klamath Falls. And then they say, well, why don't we ask the government? Maybe they'll give us a tax break. And there's lots of evidence that companies do not make siting decisions because of that marginal tax incentive, that the most important factors are other things. And we don't know for sure, but I think that I'm not willing to drain $5 million from the Klamath County government. And I know that's not my part of the state, but I still care about the functioning of their schools and their human services, and I'm going to vote no on this.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think there's some merit in the argument that our good colleague Senator Ringo makes, but I would also make as a counter-argument to that Klamath and Lake counties have negotiated carefully and arduously and over a period of years to get this company to locate in their community. And although it is true that they need not only access to a natural gas pipeline, but they need an appropriate airshed, they need appropriate infrastructure, they need appropriate siting, they need a cooperation agreement between county government and the local planning jurisdictions. And rather than looking at this as a mechanism by which the legislature deprives the local government of $5 million in revenue, I think we ought to look at this as an opportunity for the state government to help incent the development of a company that will put $700 million of investment into Klamath County. And I guess I would ask, show me another opportunity that we can identify, even as potential, that would put $700 million into Klamath County economy in the form of a capital investment, let alone the jobs that will be created. And I'm almost certain that the county has looked at the feedback model to determine what those payrolls will do for their local job base and their local income tax mechanisms and their local economy from the expenditure of payroll dollars that will go back through that community six or seven times. So the $5 million trade-off in that regard seems to me to be a relatively reasonable and well-reasoned trade-off. There is no doubt that it will affect the local county, and because they're local property taxes, it will affect the schools and the roads and the other infrastructure issues in Klamath County. But on the balance, I don't believe that the county officials would be so excited about getting this bill approved in the legislature if they thought that it was going to overall be harmful to their local economy. So I would suggest that rather than depriving that community of an opportunity, this is the bridge to that opportunity. This is what creates the opportunity.
Chair Deckard, if I may, I'm not disagreeing with Senator Ringo's perspective. I would add another consideration, and it's related to that fact of a merchant generating facility. Unlike a normal public utility, which essentially has a captive market and has a rate structure that's established through a process overseen by the Public Utilities Commission, a merchant generating facility sells its product, in this case electricity, on the market based on market prices. The cost structure that goes into that determines whether or not it's viable or competitive. Taxes of $5 or $6 million a year could have a bearing on whether or not the firm is competitive on the market. I'm not here to speak to that, but I do believe that with this fact of a free market in energy, that the equations change somewhat over what we're used to in the past. And I've just put that on the table as a consideration.
Mr. Chair. Senator Corcoran.
Well, that would make me all the more opposed to the bill, because you look at the behavior of Enron and these folks when they did do the deregulation and they did do the crisis in demand. Why would I be wanting to give a tax break to a company that we may be begging for power at a future time at a exorbitant rate that has no basis in reality? And this is not a question. Anyway, I'm not going to rant. I ranted already once today.
Well, I mean, Senator Corcoran, I guess the only thought that I have is that, in fact, we're not, because the provisions of House Bill 2671 just allows the state to allow the local community. And I think of in our community strategic investment program, which was at least somewhat similar in structure, but allowed the local people to really negotiate with some chip manufacturers. And I think the history of the 90s for Washington County, I can tell you, is that decision was a good one for allowing, by the state allowing that conversation to occur. The result of that conversation has been really hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, we're into the billions of dollars invested in that local community, and it's benefited the state budget statewide. This project on scale is actually bigger, probably, given the dollar amount that's going to be invested in that community than what was contemplated in the whole strategic investment program, because it's such a large dollar investment in a small population area. So for me, that's why I think I find myself in favor of this bill, because really I think if you look at the investment that's made, and we look at the negative revenue side to the county, but we don't gauge the positive revenue impact that the state would see, and that I think that local county would see. Senator Ringo.
I just want to follow up. You said $5 or $6 million a year.
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, that's my arithmetic. Okay. I just applied.
For how many years?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, the long-term rural exemption program allows for an exemption of between 7 and 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the county and the company have agreed upon in this case.
So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2671 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2043. What's that? We've spent a lot of time
That's
together.
That's right. Chairman Deckard and committee members, with House Bill 2043A, this is going to allow a corporate excise tax credit for corporations that provide motor vehicle insurance based on the number of miles traveled or time-based rating insurance plan. It specifies that an eligible corporation must provide motor vehicle insurance policies that are at least 70% based on a mileage-based or time-based rating plan. It limits the corporate tax credit to $100 per vehicle and $300 per policy, and the credit can only be claimed once per policy. It restricts the excise tax credit total to $1 million of the actual tax credit that is claimed for all tax years beginning January 1st, 2005, and before January 1st, 2010. So this is basically kind of like a pilot project, and it's for those insurance companies and create an incentive for them to provide these mileage-based insurance plans. And so basically with a $1 million credit limit and a $100 limit per vehicle, that represents 10,000 vehicles. So I've estimated that in 2005-07 biennium, which is where it would begin, there would be approximately 3,600 vehicles that would be that would choose to take this particular type of insurance policy and have a reduction then for the corporations of $360,000 and in the 07-09 biennium, $640,000 for the cap then of $1
million. Thank you. Ms. Hickermeyer. Mr. Lindquist and Mr. Lang, please come up if you heard your name called.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer, and I'm a program director at the Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for having us here today to talk about this bill. Before I go into my testimony, I just wanted to mention that attached to my testimony are a number of letters of support, including letters from Better World Club that offers auto insurance to customers that would be really interested in offering this option, the Community Action Directors of Oregon, the Executive Roundtable, which is a group of business executives that advise OEC, United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign, a professor of economics at Lewis and Clark, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and so all of those letters are attached to my testimony. So first, what is pay-as-you-drive insurance? Basically, it's an insurance pricing concept that directly links vehicle insurance premiums to a critical risk factor, that is, how much you drive. Under traditional pricing, what we have right now, drivers pay a fixed rate each year. This rate might include a discount for putting fewer miles on your car, but once you pay your premium, you don't have an opportunity to incrementally, you don't have an opportunity to save money by incrementally reducing your mileage. This is unfortunate because low mileage drivers are at less risk of being in an accident and ought to be rewarded accordingly. So increased vehicle miles tend to increase annual crash risk, all else being equal. Even a perfect driver faces risks out there on the road that are beyond his or her control, like an animal running across the road or mechanical failure and so on. So higher risk drivers may crash every 50,000 miles, while lower risk drivers may crash every 500,000 miles. But in either case, if you reduce your mileage, you're at less risk of being in a collision. So in other words, if you leave your car at home in the garage, basically you can't be in an accident with that car. So consumer advocates, actuaries, and others have recommended that underwriters offer what are called use-based premiums. So under this concept, you would be offered a per-mile or per-minute rate, and that rate would incorporate all of the existing rating factors. You could determine auto use with periodic audited odometer readings or through advanced technology. And drivers would either pay on a monthly basis or be provided an annual or six-month rebate for the miles that they don't drive. We believe that this should be a consumer option. An analogy is long-distance telephone service, where you have an option between an unlimited calling plan or per-minute calling plans. So what are the benefits? Basically, from a consumer perspective, you would have more control over your insurance costs. Rates would be easier to understand, kind of like how we pay for electricity or water. Pricing would be more equitable and accurate with regard to your crash risk. And coverage would be more affordable for low-mileage drivers. Many of those drivers are low-income Oregonians and senior Oregonians. Society would benefit as well. Participating drivers are expected to reduce mileage by about 5 to 15%. And the beauty of pay-as-you-drive insurance is that it doesn't raise the cost of driving. It simply converts what's now a fixed cost into a variable cost. Gives a price incentive there for reduced driving. And we all benefit from reduced traffic congestion, fewer crashes, and reduced environmental impacts like air pollution. There are also taxpayer benefits. I know you know how expensive it is to build additional lane capacity. In 1999, ODOT identified with the Oregon Highway Plan $29.1 billion in total state highway needs over the next 20 years and projected revenues of only $13.9 billion. So state and local governments basically have two choices. One choice is to raise additional revenues, you know, raising the gas tax and so on, to meet this continued growth in demand, or to get more out of the existing system by using it more efficiently. And the latter is by far the cheaper solution. So in reality, it's going to take a combination of increasing road infrastructure, providing better alternatives, and positive financial incentives like pay-as-you-drive insurance. This is a really small investment for the state to make to potentially jumpstart a change in the insurance industry that allows people to purchase insurance by the mile and save for every mile they don't drive. As more and more Oregonians choose this, the state could literally save millions of dollars and reduce accident costs and road costs. Now, congestion is concentrated in urban areas, but it really benefits everybody to promote cost-effective solutions to clogged freeways. By supporting transportation demand management in urban areas, freight moves more freely, and monies that might have otherwise been spent on building those additional lanes can be spent on these very pressing road maintenance and bridge needs. Rural drivers could save with pay-as-you-drive insurance, too. Rural drivers are in a separate insurance pool. Rural drivers live in areas that are not as congested, so that risk factor is not there. So they pay lower fixed premiums. The fixed premium being converted into a per mile premium would also be a lower per mile rate. So we've actually heard from drivers in rural communities around the state who are interested in this, communities like Central Point, Veneta, Rockaway Beach, Banks, Madras, and LeGrand have all indicated that they'd be interested in this option. Also, the Road User Fee Task Force has looked at whether there's a big difference between how much rural drivers drive and how much urban drivers drive. And they, or actually ODOT, they asked ODOT to do this. And ODOT compared counties east and west of the Cascades without interstate highways to eliminate the distortions of people traveling through, and found that counties east of the Cascades averaged 6,751 vehicle miles traveled per capita in 2000, while the counties west of the Cascades averaged 6,017 vehicle miles traveled per capita. Not a big difference. So this bill encourages insurance companies to basically test drive this concept, to pilot pay-as-you-drive insurance, and eventually offer it as a consumer option. It does not force them to convert all rates, and a company wouldn't want to do that. In other words, nobody, urban or rural, is going to be forced to purchase this type of insurance. So I think some people are concerned, though, if lower mileage drivers pay less, won't higher mileage drivers have to pay more? But remember that fewer miles driven means fewer accidents. Fewer accidents means lower claims costs. One state-level study found a 10% reduction in total vehicle mileage reduces total crash costs, insurance claims, and casualties by 14 to 18%. Those savings should more than make up for reduced revenues. Now, the insurance industry, what's their response? Well, it is expensive to file for new rate claims. It's expensive to figure out exactly what those rates should be. And so these costs have been somewhat prohibitive, and this is why we're thinking a tax credit would be a worthwhile thing to do. Progressive Insurance did pilot this in Texas, but they were using the advanced technology, the GPS satellite technology, because they were looking not only, excuse me, very dry now, they were looking not only at mileage, but at factors like where and when the car is driven, because those are also important risk factors. And they found that it's really prohibitively expensive to put that kind of technology in cars for the savings that, that customers and the insurance company was getting. But the people who participated in the pilot project, thanks, the people who participated in it were really loved it. This is what Progressive tells us. And they were saving an average of 25% on their premiums. There's also a company in the United Kingdom that is offering this to people in London. And there's an insurer on the East Coast, Plymouth Rock, that's seeking federal funding to do this as well. So what's the revenue impact? There's no revenue impact this biennium, and it was reported of what the potential revenue impact would be the next bienniums. So basically, we really hope that you're interested in this bill and that you will support it. It's a really effective, fair way to reward drivers for reducing mileage. And really what we're looking for is a pilot project to really test these assumptions. And if the companies find that the assumptions are correct, they would then need to go to the insurance division and file for the rate claims. So this is an interim step to really see how does this concept work in reality. Thanks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. It's my understanding that low miles drivers are already rewarded by lower rates. In other words, if you talk to your insurance adjuster, one of the questions in placing a policy is how many miles do you drive, and do you or don't you use your automobile to travel to and from work, or do you use it in connection with your business? And each one of those questions changes your rating. So I'm already under the impression that low mileage drivers are rewarded by lower rates.
Senator Deckert and Senator Farrelly, it is true that most insurance companies offer discounts to drivers for reduced mileage, but those discounts are not as significant. They don't really relate as much as they should to reduced mileage, because what people tell the insurance agent is not actually a proven fact. So what's offered is not as great of a reward as it would be if those were audited odometer ratings, is one answer to your question. Another is it's very different to just have a discount that's the same the entire year and to have a rate that actually, for every mile you drive less, you could be rewarded. So there's a real difference in the perception, meaning once you pay your insurance premium, you have no incentive to drive less under the current system. With a per mile rating system, you would actually have that incentive.
Mr. Chairman, I'll take that as a yes. Another question, Mr. Chairman, if I may. My wife is a low mile driver. I think we calculated that she does less than about 6,000 miles a year. On the other hand, I'm a high mileage driver. The district I live in is 34,000 square miles. My mileage is over 40,000 a year. Assuming that high mileage drivers would be charged a rate of X, and my spouse, who is a low mileage driver, would be rebated something to much lower than X because of her relatively low miles, how does the company make up the difference in the loss of revenue?
Senator Deckert and Senator Farrelly, as I mentioned earlier, you have to kind of look at it in aggregate and how the companies are encouraging people to drive less and therefore encouraging fewer accidents. And then reduced claims costs would lower the amount of, basically by reducing claims costs, the insurance companies don't have to pay out as much. And so that doesn't, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that insurance companies have it in their interest to reduce crashes, because it means they don't have to pay out as much in claims costs. And by offering a product like this, it should really they should not have to raise rates on higher mileage drivers.
Mr. Chairman, I'd need to hear that from an actuarial or somebody from the insurance companies, because my impression is that what would happen is that
eventually the higher mileage drivers would not only pay more, but that the rebates paid to the lower mileage drivers would essentially push the company into raising rates across the board, because especially without this tax incentive. Mr. Chairman, I have another question. You mentioned in your testimony that on a per capita basis, people in eastern Oregon drove 6,000 miles, or rural Oregon, about 6,000 plus or minus miles. And you mentioned a very similar number for western Oregon drivers or urban area drivers. Did you mean per vehicle or per capita?
Mr. Senator Deckert, Senator Farrelly, per capita, it's in the written testimony if I didn't say it. They were looking at per capita. I think ODOT says that the average driver in Oregon puts about 12,000 miles on their car.
Mr. Chairman, those numbers don't hold up. They are absolutely skewed or misinterpreted or somehow simply a illogical. I mean, let me give you the example. If you're... if your numbers are per vehicle, they're probably accurate. And the difference is that people in rural areas tend to own more than 2.4 cars per family. You know, there tends to be the family automobile that's used for outings, et cetera. There tends to be several vehicles that are used in farm and ranch work. Each one of the kids have a vehicle. So if you look at a family of four, they're very likely to have six or seven registered and licensed vehicles. And if you divide those by the mileage that you're talking about, then I bet you could get the average of 6,000 or 7,000 miles per vehicle. There's no way you're going to get 6,000 miles per capita in eastern Oregon. I mean, we've got distances, oftentimes it's an hour one way to the high school for kids driving to school, and I just am not going to buy the fact that it's a 6,000 mile per capita average mileage in eastern Oregon. I'm not buying it. So you're going to have to show me a lot more than you have, and I'm willing to concede that perhaps it's a per vehicle mile that you're talking about, not a per capita mile.
Senator Deckert and Senator Farrelly, this is direct data from ODOT.
I can deliver you any number of carloads of direct data from ODOT that are conflicting or confusing and subject to interpretation. Mr. Chairman, I am unconvinced by the data.
Senator Fair? Senator Ringo.
You know, with regard to Senator Farrelly's question before that about what if his wife is driving one and he driving the other, how would the company address that? I think that's for the insurance company to figure out, and would point out that there's no way the insurance companies are going to go down this road on this policy, goodbye, Senator, if they would lose money. So you just lost your committee.
We have to. Mr. Langer, Mr. Lundquist, you have the floor.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Lang. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Gales Creek Insurance Services in Portland, Oregon. We're a specialty insurance broker that is licensed in 42 states, and we do national programs for associations, affinity groups, such as Meals on Wheels, community development corporations, where we interface with insurers, underwriters, like similar risk organizations to pool risk and reduce costs to the end user, usually nonprofit organizations. I myself started in the insurance business about 25 years ago as a young person who got an internship at Lloyd's of London and was schooled in actuarial sciences. I wandered down the Willamette Valley today because through one of our national clients that we're working on a project, I ran into a gentleman named Pat Butler about 5 years ago, who in the literature on the subject of pay-as-you-go or miles-driven auto insurance was for the last 20 years sort of the lone voice talking about it, and he took me aside for an hour because I was the background I had. He thought I would be interested and explained to me the philosophy behind this. Now, he worked for an organization called the National Association of Women, and their board of directors was interested in it for two reasons. Number one, they're consumer-driven by their membership, but more importantly, in the analysis that he had done, he had found that women were the ones that were getting if you will, ripped off by the standard traditional delivery system for auto insurance, not based on how much miles that were driven. And so they let Pat go on this, and as a public policy person in the United States, he's sort of the person in the field. He spent most of last year in Texas trying to move the Texas legislature to do a pilot project, and he was successful. And as you've heard today, they entered into a trial project similar to what the state of Oregon is considering. And I came down because I absolutely support the approach that's being laid out for you today and that was passed in the House. I think it makes a lot of sense. It provides greater choice for citizens of Oregon. And to answer Dr. Ferrioli's question,
I'll call him doctor, please. Doctor Disaster, maybe.
Only addresses the big question that he's asking, which is he doesn't believe the data. Well, the answer to the question is there is no data. There are three or four large insurance conglomerates around the world that are studying it, but the problem is they can't get their hands on the data. And insurers, as most of you know, are not sort of at the high end of the innovation curve when it comes to industry. So they're going to be the last group to jump out ahead of something that's unproven. So that's why I think the approach that's being suggested to you is really brilliant, because it allows very cheaply to get your hands around a project that's being looked at worldwide. Is he returning? Because I would like to address some of his...
Mr. Chairman?
You don't know.
Senator Ringo.
You know, I have to go in about 10 minutes, and I would like to ask you some specific questions, and then if he returns, then he can hear your...
Okay.
Is that okay, Mr. Chairman?
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay. I'm curious as to, and maybe Chris is the person to answer this, or somebody else, but if this legislative body passes the bill, what is our belief or understanding that industry would implement a pilot project based on this?
Well, one of the carriers, insurers that we do business with nationally is Travelers Insurance Corporation. You've all heard of them. They're part of the Citigroup now. They have experimented with it in the last 10 years in California. When Prop 103 was passed in 1990, I believe, one of the criteria set upon by the Department of Insurance is that you could use miles driven as a rating base. And I had someone on my staff get a hold of the folks at Travelers. They've been doing it for many years, and they have bands, 0 to 4,000, 4,000 to 8,000, 8,000 to 10,000, 10,000 to 16,000. And they give this out to people that are interested, so they're nibbling at it.
But,
the other thing.
Excuse me. Maybe has anybody from OEC or any organization talked with insurance company representatives that have said, "Boy, we're really interested in if this bill passes in Oregon, then blah blah blah."
Chair Deckert, Senator Ringo, there are a couple of insurance companies. We actually have a meeting with Safeco in a couple of weeks that, you know, to get in to the top people is saying, you know, there's some interest there.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Liberty Northwest also has some interest, at least in the interest that we're hearing is that insurance companies and actuaries would absolutely tell you that the relationship is there. And there is data. There is data, but it's more aggregate-level data and not data that's good enough to say that, okay, in this bracket from 1,000 to 3,000 miles, we should charge you X. From 3,000 to 7,000 miles, we should charge you Y. That data is not there. That's why it's important to do these pilots. And insurance companies very much want that data. They aren't going to go out overnight and change the way that they do things or even offer this product. But, yes, we have heard this. And as I mentioned, there are insurance companies elsewhere that are beginning to experiment with this. So we have no assurances that this will happen, but we see this as being a way that Oregon can say, hey, Oregonians are interested in this concept, and we're inviting you to pilot it in our state.
No, I understand that. But I mean, to me, it would be more. I mean, I'm definitely for the bill. Frankly, I think it would be a very good step forward to see insurance companies implement the program. But of course, the bill only gives some incentive for them to do that, and so that's why I'm curious as to whether we think that incentive is going to lead to a pilot.
Well, it's not the incentive; it's the loss of business. The only thing that gets heads of national insurance companies going if they lose market share. And right. There's a great example. I wish he was here. Farmers in the state of Oregon and Washington get what's called a layup credit because, yes, they do have 15 vehicles and only three drivers in the household. That came into effect about 1952 by one insurance company out in McMinnville. And now every insurance company licensed in Oregon and Washington, even the mutuals, have filed the same program. So you have to remember, insurance companies are like fish. One goes to the right, they all go to the right because they're concerned about their market share.
Yeah.
The issue is how to get the catalyst to make them a little more innovative, and I think this does it.
Mr. Chair, I also want to ask, and maybe you mentioned this earlier, Chris, is what do you think is the most likely tool that insurance companies will use to measure the mileage? I mean, you're not anticipating GPS as...
Chair Deckert, Senator Ringo, I actually think that in the long run, insurance companies really would like to be able to look at other risk factors besides mileage. So I think that, I think Progressive is maybe waiting around until that technology is just standard. That's the impression that we've gotten from them. But we're really trying to convince companies when we talk to them and when this concept is talked up, that a simple odometer audit on a yearly or a six-month basis would be a way to offer it in that you'd have more people want to participate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I mean, and what's an odometer audit?
Chair Deckert, Senator Ringo, basically an insurance company and possibly the state would enter into a partnership where you would certify people who offer automotive services or your inspection and maintenance mm-hmm. folks at DEQ to look at the odometer and see whether it's been tampered with and tell the mileage and send that to the insurance company. And it used to be, and this is part of why insurance companies haven't done this, it used to be easy to tamper with odometers. Newer cars, that really is not the case. And so there's a lot of ways you can get around those issues of how do we get accurate mileage.
But the most likely scenario that you would envision is some sort of partnership with a number of body shops and a swap tire stores, whatever, but someplace where everybody could drive by and get a quick check.
Right. Be much easier than having to go visit your insurance agent.
Right.
Okay. Although insurance agents do like to talk to people because then they can sell them more. Yeah. So.
Thank you.
Travelers in California just functions on the honor system. It's a question on the application,
mm-hmm.
and people fill it out. You can also just... unobjectively, of course, analyze as underwriters do, depending on what somebody does for a living, if they're telling the truth.
Yeah.
How do politicians, where do we...
the flaw to this, the objection that was raised is that nobody's suggesting in any state that's looked at this abolishing the old system. This is just one more... Uh-huh. possibility for rating of auto insurance.
Yeah.
So someone who does drive 40,000 to visit their constituents 24 hours a day will certainly take the old system.
Yeah. I was missing the honor system.
Mr. Chair, I just want to apologize for having to leave, but I very much favor this bill and hope we continue to push it and appreciate your coming down here.
So, Ms. Lindquist.
Thank you, Senator Deckert, and I usually say the committee, but since there isn't any, since you are the committee, you have a joint role.
Yeah,
I'm Lynn Lundquist, the president of the Oregon Business Association, and it's probably somewhat unusual to have a business group maybe to come up and say, let's take a look at an innovative idea. However, I think it fits our organization quite well. This is, first of all, you've heard it before, this is a pilot program. And that's one of the reasons that we think we can step out and say that we would support this.
This is a what?
A pilot program, a pilot project, I'm sorry. because no one knows, as the two prior testifiers have said, no one knows for sure what's going to come of this. But and so it is a new idea. Let's test it in a test tube, if you will, rather than just try to implement the whole thing. So that, I think, gives us some comfort level of that. You know, the part of it's perplexing to me a little bit when we get some of the anti-comments about this proposal. First of all, it has nothing to do with urban versus rural. That's for sure. And secondly, the concept is not innovative when it comes to when we think of the basic concept of user pay. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's reverse the role for a moment. Let's say that we're going to do the gas tax based on our insurance principles. And that is, we'll take an average amount of the gas tax for everybody in the state, and then we'll dole that out to them on a once-a-year concept, and Chairman Deckert drives 10,000 miles a year, and even though your average is way below the average, and mine happens to be $50,000 a year, that we function that way. I mean, I think that would be sort of absurd. And yet we're saying that to move towards the user pay is not somehow innovative or that it's a useful process. Mm-hmm. And I think it is. I just sort of use that somewhat of a analogy there that maybe proves the point, that that's really all that we're talking about. The other thing that I think needs to be out there is that this is an attempt, even though it might be small, to have some impact on the total miles that Oregonians drive. And since it is a voluntary system, it seems logical to us that to give some incentive to reduce your miles with the air pollution and all that goes with it. And certainly from a business community, we understand if we can't meet our clean air standards, we're going to be the ones probably going to be paying the bill to help meet those clean air standards in ways that are very costly. So it's just a logical, in our explanation, just a logical attempt to look at an innovative system that's voluntary. It's a pilot program, and seems to me has an opportunity to be useful in the long term.
Thank you. So we'd like to move 2043, obviously. We don't, not that if we had the full committee here, we don't have the votes right now, so we would need an additional vote or two and then a floor vote to move the bill along. But appreciative that you've gotten the bill this far, actually quite an accomplishment. And I think, Mr. Lundquist, I think the analogy you use is actually a really good one that I hadn't thought of, but I think that could be persuasive with some folks who have misgivings, is to use the whole user pay analogy, which truly is embodied in this bill. Thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2043. And I will make the announcement that we are joining the House tomorrow at 9 for the revenue forecast. So if any of my colleagues are out there and hear me on Senate Revenue, our next meeting is at 9 a.m. in Hearing Room A to receive the revenue forecast. We're adjourned.